Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno of the George Washington University and host of Planet Forward, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. She's on a cruise with public radio listeners. President Obama meets again with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on a new strategy for Afghanistan. Iran balks at a U.S.-backed deal to limit its uranium enrichment. Secretary of State Clinton is in Pakistan and says officials there haven't done enough to fight al-Qaeda. Joining me for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup are Tom Gelton of NPR, Elise Labatt of CNN, and Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers. No shortage of interesting news, controversy this week. Elise Labatt, the Secretary of State in Pakistan, with some really very dramatic and very, by the Pakistanis' response, confrontational comments in the last few days.
Well, that's right, Frank. What she did was she went there kind of knowing that there was a lot of anti-American sentiment in Pakistan right now, not only about U.S. operations in Afghanistan and its designs on Pakistan, but a recent aid package, the Kerry Lugar legislation. And what she went there knowing this, went to do a lot of public outreach, town halls, students, meeting with tribal elders, and she really got a lot of tough questions from students, from journalists about U.S. drone operations in the region, also about the fact that the U.S. isn't doing enough to help them with the Taliban. And she gave as good as she got, Frank. She really had some unusually blunt comments about Pakistani responsibility. She says, listen, I'm here to take all of your criticism, bring it on. But you have a responsibility here. Particularly, she talked about al-Qaeda. And she said, I find it really hard to believe that the Pakistani government doesn't know where al-Qaeda is and can't get them if they want it.
The reaction to those comments, Jonathan, specifically about al-Qaeda and the Pakistani knowing where they are and not doing enough to get them caused an incredible response in Pakistan.
What we've been seeing, the confrontation with the Secretary of State is just an extension of what has been going on, this raging anti-Americanism that's taking place in Pakistan, in part a reaction to the fact that there's been this incredible increase in bloodshed in Pakistan. They're looking for someone to blame. Certainly the previous Bush administration's policies vis-a-vis the support of former dictatorship of Pakistan, the support of the Pakistani army's multiple offensives into the tribal area that have created tens of thousands of refugees and casualties. Certainly there's some U.S. Culpability, but the fact is that the Pakistanis are refusing to hold up the mirror and, as the Secretary of State says, share the blame. The fact is that the groups that are committing the atrocities in Pakistan are the Frankensteins that were created by the Pakistanis' own security services and, in particular, the ISI and the military to fight proxy wars both in neighboring Afghanistan and in neighboring Indian-controlled Kashmir. And these Frankensteins are now turning on their master.
Tom Gelton, talk about the substance of her remarks and how widespread that's felt within the United States government and elsewhere, that the authorities in Pakistan actually do know a whole lot more than they've let on and haven't done a fraction of what they could or should to turn the tide on some of these insurgencies.
Frank, what drives the Americans crazy is that the Pakistanis still seem intent on this idea that there are good Taliban and bad Taliban. Their whole offensive is directed against that segment of the Taliban movement that is really focused on Pakistan. It's largely the Massoud clan. And even as they're directing this offensive against the Pakistan Taliban, they are continuing to support, in many ways, the ISI is continuing to support the Afghan Taliban, which are, from the Pakistani point of view, the good Taliban. I mean, I have been speaking with intelligence officials about this. There is continuing evidence that the ISI is in touch with and supporting elements of the Taliban that are fighting in Afghanistan against the government in Afghanistan, particularly the Haqqani network, which has been implicated in the bloodiest attacks in Kabul itself, including the attack this week. This is what is upsetting the Americans so much, that the Pakistanis seem to have this idea that they can separate these two movements. And from the U.S. point of view, that's ridiculous.
Well, Elise, what's extraordinary about the Clinton trip is that all of these things that Tom is talking about and that Jonathan's talking about that have been taking place, and we've known it, sort of behind the scenes or in private, have kind of churned up very publicly. So she does, on Friday, Pakistan time, a TV interview broadcast live with a female anchor and a female questioners, so it's a remarkable thing. And they take questions from the audience. And one audience said the Predator attacks launched by the United States are, this is from somebody in the audience directing a question to the Secretary of State, are executions without trial. Another one says your presence, referring to the U.S. military presence in the region, is not good for peace, telling Clinton, please forgive me, but I would like to say that we've been fighting your war.
Well, back to Jonathan's point either, Secretary Clinton is trying to tell the Pakistanis, it's not just our war, it's our war. And the U.S. and Pakistan are in this together. This is a situation that in some way you created by allowing these groups to ferment. And, you know, a lot of this has been about the Pakistani obsession with India over the years. As Tom has noted, they're supporting the Afghan Taliban because they think that that supports them in their war against India. And so Secretary is saying, listen, let's not look back. Let's look forward. We're in this partnership together. Not only did she go there to try and tamp down the sentiment with her words, but she also went with a lot of money, a lot of aid, not only humanitarian and education aid, but a major energy package. Pakistan has a major energy crisis.
And this is supposed to be the smart power that we've heard about, right? Using all the tools in the toolbox, not just military, but aid, development, that kind of thing. It wouldn't appear that it's winning over a lot of converts, at least not publicly.
Well, the fact is that what we've seen happen is last year when you had the end of military rule in Pakistan, the military came out of last year's elections with the election of the civilian government with the worst reputation it's had in almost all of Pakistan's 60-year history. Due largely to the abuses that were perpetrated by the former military dictator of Pakistan, General Musharraf. So the military had been the focus of major criticism in Pakistan. Now you've seen this shift from the military, criticism of the military, to the criticism of the United States. The United States has now become the main bogeyman of the Pakistani people. And a lot of people believe, a lot of experts I know, believe that this was deliberately done by the Pakistani military to divert all of this criticism away from this. And the predator case is a case in point, in that the Predators themselves are being flown out of a Pakistani military base with the full complicity of the Pakistani military, which helps provide the United States with its targeting information.
I mean, the ultimate irony, right, is that this past week the Pakistanis have experienced at least 100 killed, 200 injured at this crowded market. There were 6 buildings badly damaged with this bombing. There's been this wave of bombings and suicide attacks across the country and potentially in response to this military offensive that the Pakistanis themselves are conducting in South Waziristan.
In fact, Frank, one of those drone attacks targeted and killed Baitullah Masood, who was the single individual most personally responsible for all those attacks inside Pakistan and was actually a hated figure in Pakistan. So what we're seeing here is some real ambivalence, I think is a mild word, on the part of the Pakistani population about who their enemy is.
What is the Pakistani government and military actually doing to take on these insurgents and the Taliban?
Well, the fact is that the Pakistani military still see that they're at very great odds, both the military and the civilian government, which has been the case in Pakistan throughout its history. The military seems still absolutely obsessed with India, and was openly critical of what's supposed to be their civilian master over the civilian government's support for this Kerry Lugar bill, the American money that came in. Unprecedented criticism by a military command that's supposed to be subservient to a civilian government under their own constitution. Because of the military's obsession with India, it has still not devoted, taken troops off its border. India remains their main focus. And indeed, because of that, and because of India's involvement now in Afghanistan, greater investments in Afghanistan, Afghanistan is now falling into the purview of the ongoing Indo-Pakistani rivalry in the subcontinent. So it's a really complicated situation.
And the operation in Waziristan is really going after the kind of refuge for the leadership of the Pakistani Taliban. And they have had some success. But what's very quiet is that they're doing it with a lot of hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. equipment, of U.S. intelligence, surveillance. They just sent some helicopters there. And so the Pakistanis, there's a point where they realize that they're facing huge internal problems. They don't want American support, but they need it. And on the issue of the Kerry Lugar bill, I mean, Secretary Clinton was, you know, very pointed when she says, listen, the U.S. is coming as a goodwill gesture to give you $7.5 billion in U.S. money, not only for humanitarian aid, but some of it is military aid. There is a lot of consternation about the conditions attached to that. But she's saying we're doing this in a global recession, 10% unemployment in the United States. And the Congress is picking up the paper and saying Pakistani is saying, no, thanks, we don't want the money. And that is very insulting to the U.S. that's trying to help you with your problem with al-Qaeda and Taliban in the country.
But you know what? We can huff and puff all we want. But the truth of the matter is that Pakistan is incredibly important to U.S. national security, regardless of the attitude of the government. It's a nuclear state. We don't know for sure where those nuclear weapons and nuclear materials are. We have no choice. In spite of all this frustrating attitude that we're coming across, we have no choice but to be patient and work with them.
Indeed, one of the most worrying things, you know, we keep hearing assurances that the Pakistani nuclear arsenal is safe. But I would point out that a couple of weeks ago, the exurgents, not from the tribal area, but indeed from southern Punjab, which is the largest part of Pakistan, the main ethnic group, made their way into the equivalent of the Pakistani military. The Pakistani Pentagon, and spent 9 hours there holding hostages. It raises the question, how did they get in there? And some people believe, experts believe, that there may have been an inside job.
We're talking to three journalists on the Friday News Roundup, taking a look at the world. Our conversation will continue. We'll invite your calls and questions at 1-800-433-8850. After this short break, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Today, our Friday News Roundup, and our guest, Tom Gelton, a correspondent for NPR, author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Elise Lebit, she is the State Department producer for CNN, and Jonathan Lande, national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And an email, folks, playing off of the conversation we've been having about Pakistan and the Secretary of State. This one coming into us just in the last minute or two. Do you think Clinton's words, comments, and statements in Pakistan are calculated and reflect Obama's policy, or has she responded personally to critics and the press? Elise?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think we're just talking at the break that it does reflect a lot of what the American public and in large part the Obama administration feels about Pakistanis' lack of ability and will to take responsibility for fighting the Taliban and going after al-Qaeda in the country. That said, Secretary Clinton is known for being unplugged. And when she gets in these conversations, we've seen in many instances on her trip, she, you know, speaks with emotion and says what she means. And I'm not sure that she meant to be as blunt as she did, but like we were saying, she was there not only to take the criticism, but to kind of have an honest conversation. She says, I'm not here for happy talk. We need to, if we're going to have a real partnership, we need to take the gloves off and discuss these issues in a real candid way.
Whatever happened to diplomacy? No, it's very interesting to see that play out, especially in Pakistan, where emotions run so deep and in such complicated ways. 1-800-433-8850. 1-800-433-8850. If you have a question for our panel, let's move to Iran. Another major development now in the ongoing saga of these negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. We thought, or the Iranians had suggested, if not said, that they could ship their low-enriched uranium out of the country. It could be processed and come back in ways that wouldn't go into nuclear weapons. Now they're saying, maybe not. Tom Gelton, what's going on?
Well, Frank, we haven't seen yet, as last I checked this morning, we haven't gotten the official reaction yet or the official response from Iran. But the unofficial response, as reported by Western diplomats who have been in touch with Iran, is that, yeah, now the government has decided that it will not go along with this proposal, which, as you said, actually originated with the Iranians a while ago. The point of that was that Iran would ship enough of its low-enriched uranium out of the country that there would not be enough left in the country for it to proceed and make a nuclear weapon. So what that did is it bought time. It would take, I mean, Iran would continue to make low-enriched uranium, but it would take about a year for them to get back to the point where they would have enough to sort of be able to move ahead on the nuclear weapon. If, in fact, they do not ship this low-enriched uranium out of the country to Russia, where it would be reprocessed and then also in France and then come back to be used in a nuclear reactor to make medical isotopes, if, in fact, they don't do that, then Iran has this nuclear material, this low-enriched uranium, and they can proceed, and we will not have bought the time. We thought, or the U.S. officials thought, that they had about a year's extra time here to deal with Iran. If this, in fact, falls through, they don't have that year.
And so, Elise, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, did an interview on your network, CNN, where she was asked about this and whether it's time to go to sanctions, and she said, I'm going to let this process play out. What's she talking about? What she mean?
Well, like Tom said, they haven't had the official proposal. The oral proposal in Vienna was that maybe they would ship out a little uranium in batches. So like you said, they wouldn't have the full uranium out of the country. Or why don't you enrich it in Iran under IA supervision? That was one of the options. Another one of the options is, how about we have some talks with the United States about the United States securing the safety of this facility? They're giving all kinds of options, and the U.S. wants and their partners want a more formal proposal so that they can respond, and then they can have negotiations on this proposal. This is the problem, that that Iran is going to drag the P5 plus one into protracted discussions and continue to bide time to develop its nuclear program, very similar to the way that North Korea did over the last
Jonathan, years. The Europeans who are part of this P5 plus one discussion with the Iranians have expressed grave concern today. They've called for the Iranians to get back to the conversation. And the Swedish foreign minister is quoted as saying, it's the same old tricks, referring to what the Iranians are doing to play for time, to offer something and then not carry through on the commitment, if it's a commitment at all. What's the leverage?
Well, it looks like here that the Iranians are trying to drive a wedge between the Europeans and the United States on one side and the Russians and the Chinese, who are also part of this negotiation, on the other. We've heard in recent days senior Russian officials saying now is not the time for sanctions. And we've seen a burgeoning economic relationship between China and Iran. And it looks, and Iran and China, we know, doesn't want to go forward with harsher sanctions. So it looks
like. And that's
like,
built largely around oil and the Chinese need for Iranian energy.
Absolutely. But I think we should also try and put ourselves perhaps in the Iranian shoes, in Iran's shoes as well. And that is, they're being told, you know, under this deal, you ship out 75% of the low-enriched uranium that you've made. They feel that that then gives them opens the door for the Israelis, perhaps, to launch a military strike against their enrichment facility. And that way, not only do they lose their enrichment facility for three or so years or however long it takes to restore it, but they've lost the leverage they have in these negotiations, which is their stocks of low-enriched uranium.
Tom Gelton, there's a lot going on behind the scenes with all of this. Mohammed El-Baradei, who's the head of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, traveled secretly to Washington to talk about what the options and alternatives and contingencies presumably are. Last weekend, President Obama spoke with both the Russian president and the French president to try to keep some form of united front here. What's happening in terms of the pressure points and trying to keep some sense of international cohesion?
Well, President Medvedev of Russia has actually spoken to President Obama about this. And this is, I think, from the U.S. point of view, this is a hopeful sign that there is, that there does, at least for the moment, there does seem to be a U.S.-Russian consensus that this proposal really is important and needs to move ahead. There's another complicating factor here, which is Jonathan mentioned you sort of have to think about this from the Iranian point of view. You know that Mir Hussein Mousavi, who was the opposition candidate, who was, you know, sort of celebrated in the West for his very defiant and even courageous stand against the regime, has come out very strongly against this proposal, saying that if the promises are realized, then the hard work of thousands of scientists would be ruined. So this is an issue where the Iranian government has to worry about opposition from the opposition movement in Iran. That's something that has completely complicated the sort of the political factors here.
All of this is going to come to a kind of head at the end of the year. The President Obama has said, after many months of saying, give it a few more months, give it a few more months, Secretary Clinton is saying, let's give it some time. But the Obama administration, and indeed many of the Europeans, have said, by the end of the year, we should know about Iran's intentions. And if we don't see that Iran is serious, we need to think of further measures. This week, the Senate Banking Committee voted on a further sanctions act, which gives the Obama administration authority to impose sanctions on companies that send refined oil to Iran. This is something the Obama administration and indeed the Bush administration before that has been loath to do, to impose gas sanctions.
Tom, tell us about a battle shaping up between Iran's Revolutionary Guards and the U.S. Treasury Department.
Well, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is this kind of parastatal organization that sort of got its origins in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution. And it has a quasi-state, quasi-private status. And what they have been able to do in the last few years is take advantage of a new privatization law in Iran under which state-owned enterprises were to be privatized. Well, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard has put on its private hat and says, and has actually taken over a majority of the Iranian economy, is now under its control.
A majority of the
Iranian economy is now under the direct control of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And the Treasury Department, in its effort to fine-tune sanctions, is trying to target those particular Iranian companies that are controlled by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
To Iraq now, and then in a few minutes to our phone calls to bring our audience into this and any other conversation that they may want to have with respect to what's going on in the world. But in Iraq, discussions amidst ongoing violence, intensifying violence in some cases, about trying to fix the national election law, because that is what is looming large. Jonathan Lande, what's the landscape look like in Iraq right about now?
Well, they've tried for a third time to pass an election law in time for the January elections, and they failed again. And the issue, there are a number of issues, but the main issue has to do with the city of Kirkuk in northern Iraq, and a city that sits atop billions of gallons of untapped oil. The issue has to do with what census is going to be used to register voters there. Now, this is a city that the Kurds, now this is right on now a predominantly Kurdish city. It was, the Kurds say, a predominantly Kurdish city before the reign of Saddam Hussein, who ethnically cleansed Kurds out of the city and brought in Arabs. The issue is, since the fall of Saddam Hussein, the Kurds have been restoring their majority in that city, and indeed other ethnic groups claim over restoring their majority, bringing in more Kurds than there had been before. The Kurds want voter registration to be based on the most recent census. I think it was, in fact, done this year. The Sunni Arabs and other ethnic groups there, the Turkmen, for instance, want the voter registration based on the 2004 census, and they have not been able to come to an agreement on this, and this has hung up the passage of this law. And what it really comes down to, it appears, is control over that massive amount of untapped
and
petroleum.
And yet this dispute, this standoff over the election law comes just after this Sunday terrible bombing in central Baghdad, the worst in 2 years, killing more than 150, wounding hundreds more, severely damaging three major government buildings. Now there's been an arrest of some 50-odd security. And there was some suggestion that this intensifying violence might drive the politicians to nail down this election law and drive those, to sort of some kind of political, if not resolution, progress. Tom?
Well, it seems, Frank, that the Iraqis have become so inured to this kind of violence that just sort of everything just proceeds normally. And that's true, I think, both in a good sense and a bad sense. In a good sense, there has been this movement towards stability and peace in Iraq, and Iraqis have been feeling more confident about their future. And they seem, amazingly enough, to have taken this bombing in stride, in a sense. I mean, there have been other bombings.
It's almost unimaginable, isn't it?
It's almost unimaginable, but this is now 6 years that they've been through this, and they seem to be able to cope with these great tragedies. On the other hand, the sort of the negative side is that, as you say, you would hope that this would jolt them into sort of some reality, but again, they become so used to this that they just sort of proceed with the same stalemate.
What's behind the uptick in violence, Elise?
Well, we saw an uptick in violence in August. And there were some also massive bombings at the foreign ministry, at the finance ministry. And this seemed to be a way to kind of sow sectarian tensions once again. And they thought that maybe this would kind of lead Iraq down the path that it was in 2006, 2007 with major sectarian tensions. Now what officials say is they think that these foreign fighters or the real hardcore al-Qaeda in Iraq are trying just at anything. They tried at economic targets. They tried at religious targets. Now they're just trying at softer targets to kill a lot of people. They think maybe it can affect the election in January. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been running as the security candidate. He's the one that's bringing stability to Iraq. He was the one that got U.S. forces out of the city. The question is now, is this going to affect his standing as the security candidate?
There may be also something else going on here. The more instability, I think, perhaps whoever is behind these bombings create in their mind, it delays perhaps the departure of American forces. And what do you get from that? Well, you get a delay or perhaps problems coming up with additional American forces to send to Afghanistan. And there may very well be that thinking going on the parts of those who are responsible for these massive bombings.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'd like to have you join the conversation at 1-800-433-8850. That's 1-800-433-8850 as we survey the world this Friday. Or you can email us at drshow@wamu.org. Before I go to the phones, one bright spot perhaps in the world, Honduras. Honduras's ousted president, Manuel Zelaya, reached an agreement with the interim government. The Secretary of State spoke about this on her trip. What's the latest, Elise?
The latest is that the negotiators between the de facto government of Roberto Micheletti and President Zelaya have come to an agreement about a national unity government. It still needs to be kind of signed off by the Supreme Court and ratified, if you will, by Congress. But it seems to pave the way for the elections to take place on November 29th. The international community has been very concerned that the standoff would have an impact on the elections. And there was a concern that the elections would not be accepted by the international community. The problem is that the whole Western Hemisphere, if you will, has really climbed down from their major insistence that President Zelaya be returned before the election. It's really unclear what's going to happen to him. But there was some strong insistence that he return because the fear was that this would set a precedent for other coups in the region. Now, by saying he can come back soon, maybe he can come back a couple of days before the election, maybe after the election, before the inauguration, maybe not at all, this raises questions whether anybody in Latin America, if they have persistence and the resources, can launch some kind of coup and buy their time and affect the political situation that way.
Tom Gelton, you know Latin America, Central America very, very well. What are the implications and consequences of what we're seeing play out in Honduras?
Well, I think that what we've seen here, and it's partly coming off what Elise just said, but what we've seen here is the marginalization of Latin America in U.S. foreign policy. I mean, what happened here is that Tom Shannon, the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America, finally goes down to Honduras with Dan Restrepo, the NSC expert on Latin America, and they craft out this deal. But I know from talking to a lot of people who were involved behind the scenes, there's been great frustration that the Obama administration just has not engaged with this issue for weeks. And why did it take this long for this deal to get worked out? And as Elise says, Latin Americans have been, you know, they've got the feeling they just don't count.
Let's go to the phone. Cynthia from Vernon, New York, joins us now. Hi, Cynthia. If you could, we have to take a break in just a moment, so I'm going to ask you to be as succinct as you can with your question, but thanks for joining us.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Should I talk?
Yeah, go ahead,
okay.
Please.
Okay, we have to choose between war and peace. You can't have peace without diplomacy, and our Secretary of State is not the person to use diplomacy. And the other thing is that when she said that it was a cowardly act, of course it was, for anybody to kill those innocent people in Pakistan, but they never say that it's a cowardly act for our guys over here in New York and Nevada to sit at a computer all day, operate the drones, and the people are killed. Then those guys go home for supper, and then they're coaching their kids' soccer games. Oh. I mean, you know, we have to use diplomacy.
Thanks, Cynthia. We're going to talk about what diplomacy means and the implications to your question after we take a quick break. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org, and by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose Subsidy Scope project provides information about federal subsidies across industries at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen to an interview with the photographer Roy DeCarava, who died this week at the age of 89. He was born in Harlem and dedicated his 60-year career to documenting African-American life, taking pictures of the everyday as well as the iconic. Duke Ellington was one of his many subjects. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to the Friday News Roundup. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Our guests, Tom Gelton from NPR, Elise Labatt from CNN, and Jonathan Lande from McClatchy Newspapers. We have some emails. Let's go right to them and then back to the phones. Why is this resolution in Honduras, writes an emailer, a good thing for Latin America with a history of usurpations of power? The ousting of Zelaya was a constitutional response to his actions. The solution is extra-constitutional. Tom Gelton.
There's been so much extra-constitutional things that have happened in Honduras in the last few years that, you know, you're sort of at a loss to know where to begin. I mean, the line between constitutionality and unconstitutionality is pretty blurry in Honduras. This whole thing, Frank, has been so sad. I mean, it has just sort of made clear how far Honduras and other governments in Latin America have to go in terms of really establishing a sound democratic, strong democratic foundation. I mean, a lot of the players behind the scenes in this Honduras situation, beginning with the church, have really played pretty disgraceful roles, I have to say.
Elise, let's come back to Cynthia's call before we took the break. She was talking about the very undiplomatic language coming from the Secretary of State.
Well, I think you see a new effort by Secretary of State Clinton to redefine what diplomacy means. Diplomacy doesn't mean sitting at a conference table with a bunch of leaders and making nice words. It means getting out, talking to the people, talking frankly about the issues that United States and various countries share. And I think this was an example of that. The good thing about Hillary Clinton is you never know what's going to come out of her mouth. The bad thing is that you never know what's going to come out of her mouth and how it's going to reverberate throughout the country.
Jonathan, an email from Chet, who writes, those in power in Afghanistan and Pakistan benefit personally from having a resurgent Taliban and viable al-Qaeda. As long as the fighting goes on, U.S. money keeps flowing into their secret accounts or diverted into Pakistan. If they win the war on terror, they know we'll abandon them, as we did after the Soviet army left. We're being played for chumps. What do you think about what Chet's saying?
Well, there are a lot of people who actually believe that. But the fact is, that there's enormous amounts of corruption in both countries. But the United States has incredible national security interests at stake in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I guess the calculation has been for years that it's better to try and help stabilize both countries, or at least Pakistan, especially now because they have nuclear weapons, than it is to walk away.
Well, let's go to the phones. Bruce joins us now from Logan, Ohio. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how are you?
Just great. Thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question.
You know, I worked in the Middle East for a couple of years, and that doesn't make me an authority, but it does give me a perception that probably a lot of people don't have here. And, you know, the issue in Islamic countries is always going to be the only people really fooled by the United States rhetoric and our principled stands are Americans, you know, our support of Israel. And the common perception that we don't object to their military conduct or to their nuclear capacity makes us seem as hypocrites in the Middle East. Everything falls apart after that.
So what would your question be in the context of what we've been discussing today?
Well, you know, the issue is so hard because the governments in the Middle East aren't trusted by the people who align themselves with the United States. And we never deal honestly. I really don't know how to form it as a question. Mm-hmm. We just don't have an open debate in this country that we're sitting here talking about things, but the only people we're talking to are Americans. Islamic people hear a totally different thing. They hear a totally different message.
Tom Gelton?
Well, I think that Bruce has a point that you know, I think that he's right. The fact that he's lived in the Middle East gives him probably more sensitivity to the way that we are perceived in those countries, and it's something that we may forget from time to time. But I'd also say that it's a very complicated situation. I mean, I think a lot of people there don't trust their own governments. I think there is some real a real gap between the governed and the governors in many of those countries. There are also serious tensions between Muslim countries. I mean, the Gulf states don't trust Iran, and you get the feeling that some of the people in the Gulf states would be perfectly happy for Israel to attack Iran or for the United States to attack Iran. So I think that the amount of mistrust generally in the Middle East is just tremendous.
And certainly, at least, the Obama administration had hoped to put Middle East peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians and others on something of a parallel track so they could make progress there. They recognize that that is central, just like previous administrations have recognized it. They're not making very much progress.
On, like, the second or third day of office, President Obama appointed George Mitchell as the special envoy, said, let's get going on trying to get peace talks. And he he made the settlements, the settlement freeze, as one of his key issues, and getting Arabs to take steps to Israelis. And a lot of people now think he miscalculated, because in all these many months since they took office, they have not been able to relaunch negotiations. They've been really going at it. Secretary of State Clinton is traveling to the Middle East this week to meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, try and get some kind of process going, enough talking about, you know, what should be, what shouldn't be. Let's sit down at the table and hammer it out. But it doesn't seem to be going that far. There's no sense that the Israelis really have the will to negotiate a two-state solution. And the Palestinians have lost complete confidence that the Obama administration is able to bring the Israelis around.
Sam joins us now on the phone from College Park, Maryland. Hi, Sam. Go ahead with your question for us.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for taking my call. This is Sam. I'm calling from College Park. I'm an Iranian student here in the United States, and I have two points I want to make, and basically two questions that I'm kind of wondering why the United States and all the think tanks do not put this situation, think about this, that communicating with the Iranian people can open the channels by bypassing the regime and the government, so the people can actually go back and forth and understand more about the United States. So then the government will lose all the image that it had created from the United States, because they created an untouchable entity from the United States that no one can actually see, no one can actually come, no one can actually understand it. So they have this enemy to use this as a leverage to actually against their people. So
you're asking why isn't the United States communicating more directly with the Iranian people?
Exactly. For instance, coming to the United States is a great dream for almost all the Iranians, but getting a visa is a great hassle. Now, opening the borders for the Iranian people, I'm not saying that you have to open all borders for everyone, but making it more accessible for the Iranian people, then the regime will suddenly see that it has lost its enemy. Then it cannot say anything about the United States then. This is one point. And the other point is, sanctions will definitely not work. This is something that put all the Iranians behind the regime, not supporting the regime, but they think that, well, here it is. The United States is again putting some sanctions against us. But again, creating Iran like a hotspot in internet. For instance, we can put McDonald's, Starbucks, everywhere a hotspot. Why don't Iran and the big cities a huge hotspot for the internet, so everybody can access free internet, free media, free information? Again, then the regime will see, okay, it has lost its credibility.
Okay, Sam, thanks very much. I want to turn to Jonathan for a response to this. Why not communicate more with the people, and what about sanctions?
Well, I think that there was a great deal of effort being put in to trying to allow the Iranian people to have free voice during the protests that were launched against the regime in the aftermath of the election that many Iranians thought was rigged and stolen from the opposition. You saw the United States government actually getting behind efforts to create alternative servers, ways for Iranians to communicate when internet servers in Iran were turned off by the Iranian regime. And indeed, the caller makes a good point. There's a big question as to how long the Iranian regime would be able to maintain its control if it didn't have the United States as kind of the great Satan that it uses to demonize, to blame for Iran's problems as a way of trying to maintain national unity. And you saw them doing that when they were trying to respond to the violence that their own forces perpetrated against the demonstrators in Iran after the elections, where they were blaming the violence, they were blaming the demonstration on the United States, on Britain. Just the other day, a local Iranian employee of the British embassy was convicted. I think he was given 4 years in prison for allegedly playing a role in these demonstrations. So he does have a point that the Iranian regime does use the great Satan, the United States, and other Western countries as foils to blame for many of its own internal problems.
Tom Gelton, sanctions, as the caller suggests, could backfire.
Yeah. We spoke earlier about the role of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard in the Iranian economy. One of the consequences of them taking such a large role in the economy is that they now also control the black market. They built a number of jetties. They control a big portion of the international airport in Tehran. And what that means is that whenever you have sanctions, what you really see is a flourishing black market. It's really a promotion of black market and smuggling opportunities. So ironically, perversely, sanctions against Iran could actually strengthen the role of the Revolutionary Guard.
Let's go to the call. Mike joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Mike.
How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, I got a question for all you. If Pakistan is unable to hold on to their nuclear capability due to insurgents getting inside their infrastructure, would we have to step in as a whole, as the UN or United States would have to go in? And if that would happen, would we have a draft?
There's the nightmare scenario. Who wants to take that on?
Well, a draft wouldn't help. You'd have to step in a lot more quickly than a draft could help you. I think the problem is that the United States does, as far as I know, the United States does not actually know where all the nuclear materials are. And therefore, you know, you can't talk about some kind of special operation to go in and secure those materials because we just don't know where they are.
We haven't spoken yet in our conversation here about where the Obama administration is in its deliberations about what's next in Afghanistan. And that is something that has occupied the White House and foreign policy and military experts in this town at a very high level over this past week. What's happened? What has progressed?
Well, there's, in fact, another strategy session to be held today at the White House. President Obama meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss this very issue. There have, however, been some controlled leaks coming out of the administration this week about where the deliberations appear to have been, because, as I said, there are leaks and there's a negotiation going on. But right now, it's looking as if you believe the leaks, that they're looking at less than what General Stanley McChrystal, who is the U.S. commander in Afghanistan, has been recommending in terms of the strategy that he put forward, but not going to this minimal strategy that the vice president and others have been advocating, which is basically a counterterrorism strategy, focusing more on Al-Qaeda. And it raises the question as to whether or not what's going to come out of all of this is going to be a politically driven strategy, a strategy driven by domestic politics and not military necessity.
Elise Labatt, what are you hearing?
Well, and also driven by local politics. There seems to be more of a debate about what's going on in the local provinces where the government is strong and where would be U.S. troops would be best needed. This really reflects a shift to making stronger allies in the provinces, not relying so much on a weak central government that now has questions about its legitimacy. It seems that they're going to do that and see if they can find some allies. And also protecting the population centers, because don't secure the border, secure some of these population centers, and that will keep insurgents out and give Afghans a stake in their future.
I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us in our remaining moments, please do at 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Going to Tony now in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Tony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Kessner. I was wondering if you or your guests have an opinion. When President Obama met with Prime Minister Netanyahu recently, he sort of softened his freezing the settlements approach. What would happen if the United States said, we will freeze your assets in the United States if you don't freeze the settlements?
Tom Gelden, you're chuckling.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen.
Why?
I mean, that's kind of apples and oranges, isn't it? Or even something more extreme than that. You know, we freeze assets of sort of enemy governments when we have reason to hold them accountable for something. I don't think there's any idea here that Israel has done something really criminally wrong.
What Tony is getting at, Tom, and you hear this a lot, is why doesn't the United States bring
right.
its pressure to
right.
bear on the Israelis in the serious way? It says, stop the settlements, please stop the settlements, please stop the settlements, but the Israelis don't, and the U.S. keeps saying, please stop the settlements.
Well,
that's
the first
perception.
Remember, the first
anyway.
President Bush did this when Secretary of State James Baker was when James Baker was Secretary of State, and we actually suspended loans to Israel for a time. It is extremely controversial. That's the last time, as far as I know, that a U.S. administration has really taken strong action.
Did it work?
Didn't work.
Didn't work. Back to the phones for another caller. Grayson joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Grayson, you there? Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes. I was just wondering, what is publicly known about the long-term motives of the Iranian leadership? Is it just a Napoleon complex, or, I mean, is a primary desire just to see Israel wiped off the map, or is there something more to it?
Grayson, thanks for your question. Complicated one there, too, because when you talk about the Iranian leadership, you actually have to define who the Iranian leadership is, what their motives are. Their motives, publicly known?
Jonathan? You know, the Iranian leaders have the same interests in protecting their country and pursuing what they perceive as being their national security interests as the leadership of any country does. And they look around the neighborhood. They are the largest country in the neighborhood. They are a power in the neighborhood. They believe they should be accorded that status. They look on both on two of their borders. They see American forces on both of their borders. They see American forces in the Persian Gulf. And they're responding to that to a great extent.
In our remaining time, let's look ahead. We've talked a bit about Afghanistan. The decision from the administration on what's next is pending. Any indication from what you're hearing from your sources as to when that decision is going to come down, Elise?
It sounds like it's going to be sometime between the November runoff election and in early November, and when President Obama heads off in the middle of the month to Asia, where he's going to consult with allies. He's going to be traveling and meeting with a lot of leaders. He'll be meeting with the president of China, for instance. So I think he wants to make his decision in between then.
It's only a three-day period.
Yeah, well, actually, we're in November already, so it sounds like it is.
And Tom, a major signal sent with whatever that decision is, not just here in the United States, but around the world.
Exactly. And you know what? It's one country that's going to be looking very closely is Russia, because Russia has really woken up, I think, to the danger of its own sort of Islamist radicalism. And I think they are looking to see if the United States really sort of backs off in Afghanistan. I think the Russians will be very worried by that, actually.
Tom Gelton, Elise Labatt, and Jonathan Lande, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Have a
thank
good
you.
Weekend. Have a good Halloween. And thank you very much for joining us on The Diane Rehm Show. Thanks for listening. I'm Frank Sesno.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.